The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Welcome back from lunch. I do want to say I feel for David. I think he's up there in the corner. I do feel for David. He said he feels like he's caught between the two, getting attacked from both sides, and I just wanted to acknowledge that and say I'm sorry. That's been a frustrating thing. Certainly not my intention to do any attacking or anything. So. I hope not going to make this day any more uncomfortable for you than it seems like it's already been. Now, I want to make two corrections. One is, Chris Mulhern said 380,000 million years.
Oh, he did.
Which is actually the right number rather than the wrong number. That was one to Charlie, one to David. I am here on this topic, but it is also true that I believe in original sin and historical Adam and Eve. That's a correction there for old Earth Christians. Now you won't find the images in my presentation, the nice pretty pictures that people have been showing, keeping me awake. Well, there's going to be none of that this afternoon, so just in time for a bit of an afternoon nap. Hopefully it won't be that bad. But yes, the case for, biblical case for an old earth. So basically, my job is to talk a bit about the Bible now. We've been doing other things, but talk a bit about the Bible. And I can say what I am not going to say is that I am not going to argue that a six-day understanding of Genesis 1 is impossible or, as it were, repugnant to the scriptures. I'm not going to be arguing that. What I will be doing is trying to show that the Bible can be read in a theologically and historically consistent and coherent way without a six-day young earth creation being required by the scriptures. Okay, so in a sense, I'm not actually making a case, in a sense, for an old earth that is arguing for it. I am saying I'm going to be making the argument that the Bible allows for that as a possibility in a perfectly historically and theologically consistent way. Okay, so that's where we're headed. That's where, what I think I'm doing. Okay, that's what I think I'm here to do. Now, in order to do that, we're going to start in Genesis 2, that I alluded to last night, and so we're going to look a little bit at some of the key players. We're going to look at Genesis 1, we're going to look at Genesis 2, and some other bits of the early part of Genesis. We'll be back and forth in the New Testament and so on as well, trying to understand what these passages are, what they're about, and so on. And then we'll finally get to the point where I will reveal to you the question I didn't answer last night appropriately, which is how can a Christian believe in old ages and old earth and so on and have it be consistent with the scriptures. Okay, so hopefully unpack a bit of the Bible first, and then we'll get into the telling of the story, as it were. Okay, so off we go. So where we're going to start, as I said, is with Genesis 2, and so the story that ends in Revelation 22, I argue, starts in Genesis 2, verse 4, not in Genesis 1, verse 1. So that is the history of God's interaction with his creation, the interaction with his people, the salvation history, as theologians refer to it. I'm saying that starts in Genesis 2, verse 4, rather than 1, verse 1. Okay, so there's where we're heading now. So why do I say that? Well, there's this Hebrew word, toledot, which is basically the word that is translated. I can't read that. Anyways, okay. In Genesis 2, verse 4, this is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created. This is the account of. Okay? Or it's a genealogical word. Okay? It's the begat sort of word. Okay? It's that genealogical word. So this is the kind of family history of the heavens and the earth as they were created. That's where this starts at 2 verse 4. Now, interestingly, that formula, that toledot formula, carries on through the book of Genesis, and this keeps the story going. It kind of keeps rebooting the story as we go through. This is the written account of Adam's line. This is the account of Noah. This is the account of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. This is the account of Shem. He gets double dip. This is the account of Terah. This is the account of Abraham's son Ishmael. This is the account of Abraham's son Isaac. This is the account of Esau, that is Edom, and again Esau. This is the account of Jacob. And so it runs right through Genesis, carrying that storyline along. Now, interestingly, when you get to the opening of the New Testament, in Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, what you find is this: a record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And that, of course, the Old Testament was originally written in Hebrew, at least that chunk of it that's quoted there in Genesis. The New Testament was written in Greek, so there's not a direct correspondence there. But when the Old Testament was translated into Greek in a couple hundred B.C., the word that is translated, that is used to translate that Hebrew word toledot, is the same word as is used in Matthew for the genealogy of Jesus Christ. Okay, so that is to say, it's the same word. It's the same concept, the same word being picked up there in Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. And why am I pointing this out? I'm pointing this out because of my thesis here that the story that ends in Revelation 22 starts in Genesis 2, verse 4. That is, we get to Matthew chapter 1, and that verse begins a long genealogy of right down to Jesus. And so the idea is that the history that culminates in Jesus, the story that ends in Jesus, which I think is what that genealogy is actually pointing us to, is that that's the Jesus represents the end of history, the fulfillment of history, according to God's plans. So when we get to the end of history, what we look back to as the beginning is that little formula that kicked us off in chapter 2, verse 4 of Genesis. So Matthew 1 doesn't look back beyond that. It looks back to Genesis 2, verse 4, and that account of the heavens and the earth. Okay, so you'd say that, in a sense, is the creation account, as it were, that Matthew is looking back to. That's one example of why I see 2:4 in Genesis as the beginning of the story. Another reason, and I'll just give you two reasons now. There's not going to be time for me to go through all the reasons for every step along the way, but in question time, I'm happy to keep churning out the examples if that's helpful. Okay, so now comparing Revelation and Genesis. So again, looking at the end of the story and see how it compares to the beginning of the story and trying to understand what the end of the story thinks of the beginning. Okay. The great streets, so in Revelation, this is a picture of heaven, a vision given to John. The great street of the city was of pure gold. This is the heavenly Jerusalem, the new creation. Pure gold, like transparent glass. So there's gold in the new city. Again, the foundations of the city walls were decorated with every kind of precious stone. And there's sort of precious stones you see in the imagery of this new creation. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life. So not only do you have the river flowing through the new creation, the new city, but you have the tree of life there as well. Again, from Revelation, I did not see a temple in the city, because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. The temple is the place in Hebrew theology and national practice, national reality, where God meets with his people. That's where God and people can come together, as David was talking about before, because of the sacrifices. they were in a sense allowed to at least symbolically come together in the temple. And so what you see in the new creation is that God is there. There's no temple. There's no mediating reality anymore between God and his people. There's just God and his son, the Lamb of God. Okay, so now that's from Revelation, the end of the story. And so just a quick, easy flip back to Genesis 2. And in the Garden of Eden, you've got the gold of that land is good. Aromatic resin and onyx are also there. So you've got gold in the Garden of Eden. You've got precious stones in the Garden of Eden. There were rivers watering the garden that flowed from Eden. There were splits into four rivers and so on. You have in the middle of the garden were the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So again, it's a recapitulation of Genesis 2, is what we're actually seeing at the end in the new creation. And then also, of course, familiar from Genesis 3, then the man and his wife heard the sound of the Lord God as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day. So that presence of God, that direct, unmediated presence of God was there in the Garden of Eden, just as it will be in the new creation, in this heavenly Jerusalem. For which we have this vision in Revelation 22. So that's very brief, but there's just two examples of why I see Genesis 2 verse 4 as the beginning of the story, of the kind of history that is told in the scriptures, rather than looking back to 1 verse 1. Okay. Now, so what is Genesis? So if I'm going to excise Genesis 1 off the off the front there, then what is it? Because I still believe it's important and it's there. So what is it? Well, let me just first say what it's unlikely to be. And again, I'm just going to only give one example of why I think this is the case, and then I'll move on. But again, I'm happy to get hit with questions later on. What is unlikely to be? Well, I think it's unlikely to be the first 7 days of the history of the universe. That's what I think it's unlikely to be. And my one example for why I think that is the seventh day. Okay, so and this is familiar territory to the Christians in the room. But the days go, there's morning and evening on the first day, morning and evening on the second day, and so on. Evening and morning. On through day six. And then you get to day seven, where God creates the rest, this rest there where he rests from his work. And that day doesn't have an evening and a morning. Right? That's again, familiar territory probably to most of the Christians in the room. That day doesn't have an end. It's an eternal day. It's an eternal state, this rest. And so the question comes, when was day eight? What flows on from day seven? I would argue that nothing flows on from day seven. It's actually eternity that's being described in day seven, not the seventh day of the beginning of the universe. Okay? One example. Okay, so what is it unlikely to be? There's my quick point there. What is it likely to be? Well, that becomes a little bit more complicated. But for its original hearers, I think it's probably something like this. A response to the idolatry of Israel as a preparation for entering into the promised land. Okay, so you can sort of picture the scene. The Israelites have been wandering through the wilderness. They've been brought out of Egypt by God and his mighty acts of deliverance. They've been wandering through the desert for 40 years because they had sinned and turned away from God. They're now sitting on the plains of Moab. They're on the east side of the Jordan, and they're getting ready to go in. God said, now's the time. Yes, you can go into the land, and I'm going to go with you. And so Moses, the first five books of the Bible are typically understood to have been written by Moses. The rest of the Bible suggests that that's the case. So in the fifth book, which comes, so you have Genesis, which is the story of the patriarchs, and you've got Exodus, which is the story of the deliverance from Israel, from Egypt, deliverance of Israel from Egypt. And then you've got Leviticus, which is largely a description of the ceremonial life of Israel. Then Numbers, which picks up at Numbers 11 or 10 or 11, with the journey of the Israelites through the wilderness, and then Deuteronomy. And Deuteronomy takes place in the wilderness, on the plains of Moab. And what Deuteronomy is, this book of Deuteronomy, the fifth book, the last book of Moses, is basically speeches, sermons that Moses is giving to the people of Israel to prepare them for their entry into the land. He's been told by God he's not going to be allowed to go into the land. This is his final will and testament to the people. He's preaching his heart out to them to say, this is what life's going to be like in the land. And so he says, I'll do the other one first. So he says in his speeches, this is from Deuteronomy chapter 4. Sorry, I didn't put a reference there. Deuteronomy chapter 4, on that right-hand column, he says to them, "You saw no form of any kind the day the Lord spoke to you at Horeb," that's Mount Sinai, "out of the fire where the Ten Commandments were delivered to Israel. You saw no form. Therefore, watch yourselves very carefully so that you do not become corrupt and make for yourselves an idol, an image of any shape, whether formed like a man or a woman, or like any animal on earth, or any bird that flies in the air, or like any creature that moves along the ground, or any fish in the waters below. And when you look up to the sky and see the sun, the moon, and the stars, all the heavenly array, do not be enticed into bowing down to them and worshiping things the Lord your God has apportioned to all the nations under heaven." And the book of Deuteronomy goes on, every other paragraph, it feels like, is that kind of paragraph. It's this incredible series of sermons that are warning the people of Israel about what they've done in the past, the idolatry they've fallen into in the past, and that this is the thing that's going to trip them up when they go into the promised land. That's what's going to trip them up. They're going to go in there, there are going to be other gods being worshipped, and they're going to be enticed to worship these other gods, these false gods, the idols of the other nations. And he's pleading with them not to fall into that trap. And so when you look back then at Genesis 1 and you start reading through the way Moses describes the creation and the way he lays it out and talks to us about the creation, God's relationship to creation, these are the kind of things he says. "Now the earth was formless and empty, darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters." Well, the Babylonian and Canaanite gods around, they were gods of the deep. The deep, the waters, gave rise to all of these gods. The gods were formed out of the great waters and the deep. Here's a comment, I think, from Moses saying that those gods, they're nothing. God is over them. They're not gods in their own right. God is the only true God. And then he says on day 4, "God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars." Now, what's very curious about this? Well, Hebrew has perfectly good words for sun and moon. There's no problem with coming up with a word for sun and moon. Moses knew the words, but he didn't put them in there. Why is that? Well, I suggest to you that he didn't put them in there because they were the names of Canaanite gods. Because they worshipped the heavenly beings, the heavenly spheres. Because they worshipped them, he said, no, they're just lights in the sky. One's bigger, one's smaller, and that's it. That's all they are. And then it says, and he also made the stars. So again, it's asserting God's total sovereignty over creation and his unimpeded creation of the world. There is no other God there fighting back against him. And again, so God created the great creatures of the sea and every living and moving thing with which the water teems. And again, the sea creatures were a feature of the sort of pantheon of the local gods. And again, you see this kind of, it's a reminder that God is the one. God created them. They're not something to worry about. So when you go into the land, nation of Israel, this is the God, this is the true God who has delivered you out of Egypt. This is the God who has delivered you out of Egypt. And when you go into the land, do not settle for second best. Don't be fooled into worshipping the false gods of the land. I think that's one thing that this is at the very least. For its original hearers, I think it's a response to the idolatry that Israel had committed, and basically a preparation for them to go into the land. So from the point of view of theological understanding, I think that's what it is. And that it fits the scene in which Moses would have been not pen to paper, but, stylus to chunk of rock or whatever it was. Okay, so now what about for us today? As Christians understand the Bible in the sense of progressive revelation, picture it like that movie Seven Up. That series of movies, Seven Up, where it's meant to flow out of, I think it's Francis of Assisi, right? Give me a child when he's seven, and I'll show you the man. And so there's a series of movies that the same director has followed this set of boys and girls when they were seven. And every 7 years, they go back and they interview them again. And I think they were 63 the last time, or maybe that's the next one. No, I think that was the last time they were 63. Anyway, it's absolutely fascinating. And they show, as part of the film, they show the kind of progression of these people's lives and the way, their understanding of themselves kind of evolves over time. And yet you can see from the very beginning, testimony to the truth of that statement that, give me the boy when he's seven, and I'll show you the man. It's a little bit like that with the Bible. That is, the first people had revelation from God, and they wrote it down, or they kept it orally, however it was initially. Of course, we eventually got it all written down. And they understood things from that. Right, that meant something to them because it was for them. It was directed to them and for their situation. And then, as war was revealed, that was added on. And then all of a sudden, you started looking back and looking at both chunks of revelation, and you see, I can now see further meaning in that. I can see how the past has shaped the future. I can see how the future helps me to understand the past a little bit differently or with a different layer of meaning. That's the way the Bible works. That as revelation is added on, you find that the meanings of things, new meanings come out of passage. So for us today, it is very much still, a tract against idolatry for us today. That hasn't changed one little bit. But now, as it sits now, not at the front of the first five books of the Bible, but as it sits at the front of 66 books of the Bible, the complete canon, I think it sits more easily as something like an overture to the entire Bible. Okay, so an overture, Andrew Lloyd Webber, right? In all of his musicals, this is, I think, the best analogy. You sit down in the theater to see, Jesus Christ Superstar or something, or whatever it is, and the music starts playing, and it's all these themes that you start hearing melodies, and they're all woven together, and they come and they go, but that's not the first song. That's not the story. That's giving you a picture of all the different kinds of themes that are going to be popping up and coming out, the melodies of the songs that you're going to be hearing throughout the rest of the story. It's the overture. It's not actually part of the history itself, but it's there. It's important. It leads you into and gives you a picture of, almost foreshadows in a way, what the story is going to be like. And so in my sort of more unguarded moments, I sometimes think of this not just as an overture, but as a synopsis, in fact, of the entire salvation history. Some sort of little abstract of the history of God's relationship with his people. So overture, what? Yeah, now, why am I saying that? Well, again, a couple of examples just to illustrate what I'm talking about. In John 1, 1-18, now, that section of John, the opening of John, is a prologue. There's no one who doesn't think that that's a prologue. It's not part of the story of John, as it were. It's that starts in verse 19. It's a prologue. And you know how it goes. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And so here's some snippets from there. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. So you can see, right from the beginning here, we've got the gospel writer John thinking about Genesis 1, what John is writing is a prologue, right? He knows he's writing a prologue, and it's interesting to see that he's referring to Genesis 1. Is he thinking that, in fact, Genesis 1 is that it sits in the same position relative to the scriptures as his prologue sits in relation to the life of Jesus? And it works right through. In the beginning was the Word, so that's that verse 1. Right, through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. So the creation begins, stuff is being made. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. All of a sudden we have light coming into the world. And then there came a man who was sent from God. His name was John. He came as a witness to testify to the light. He's not the light, etc., etc. Then that next paragraph, the true light that gives light to every man was coming into the world. So there you go. Man coming into the world. Alright, you have in the beginning, you have everything being created, you have light coming into the world, and then you have a man coming into the world. And what we find at the end of that prologue is that man is in fact in the image of God. No one has ever seen God, but God the one and only who's from the Father's side has made him known. So what you find is that man who's coming into the world is the image of God, just like it's described in Genesis 1. And so here's a prologue from Jesus' life that is referencing and recapitulating, intentionally trying to show fulfillment of this prologue from the beginning of the Bible. So there's one. Another one is, and this will be the last one for these examples, another one is Jesus in the image of God, and so we just refer to that there. But in Genesis 1, it says this: Then God said, Let us make man in our image and our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. Okay? Straightforward. We've heard that before. We've heard it this weekend already. Now, in Psalm 8, a lot later on, it says this: When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. You made him ruler over the world, works of your hands. You put everything under his feet, all flocks and herds, the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, and the fish of the sea, all that swim the paths of the seas. So can you see what this writer here, presumably David, was talking about? He's writing a poem as he reflects on Genesis 1, right? That's what he's doing. He's reflecting on the creation of humanity in the image of God and being given dominion and rule over creation under God's ultimate rule. So Psalm 8 is pointing us back to this creation moment of human beings being created in the image of God to have dominion. Now, if you jump forward to the New Testament and the book of Hebrews, in chapter 2, says this: It is not to angels that he, that's God, has subjected the world to come, about which we are speaking, but there is a place where someone has testified. What is man that you are mindful of him? Okay, so he's repeating Psalm 8. The son of man that you care for him. You made him a little lower than the angels, you crowned him with glory and honor, and put everything under his feet. In putting everything under him, God left nothing that is not subject to him. Yet at present, we do not see everything subject to him. But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, now crowned with glory and honor, and because he suffered death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. So you see what's happening is the writer of Hebrews looks around the world and reflects on Psalm 8 and Genesis 1 and says, well, we, at present we don't actually see everything subject to this man that was created back there, do we? And then he says, well, hang on. Maybe we do, because everything is subject to Jesus. So maybe he's that man that was being referred to back in Genesis 1. Maybe Jesus is the fulfillment of that image of God coming into the world. Now, the interesting thing about this, I would suggest to you, is that for the rest of the New Testament, well, throughout the New Testament, when the image, when something is discussed as being in the image of God, it's Jesus. Jesus is the one who, in the New Testament, is the ultimate image of God, the exact representation of his being. Romans 8, 2 Corinthians 4, Colossians 1, which David showed us earlier. Jesus is the image of God. That's who the New Testament thinks is the image of God. And even more fascinating is that when you look at Christians as they're described in the New Testament, what you find is that the Christians are being created or recreated into the image of Jesus, not into the image of God in the New Testament. Fascinating. So is this saying, I bet it's like, so Romans 8 says, we're being created in the image of, that's not the right verse. All things work together for good for those who love him, for being someone shout out the reference for me. It's 8:30 something. Sorry about that. But yes, when Christians are discussed as being in the image of something, and the new creation, they're described as being in the image of Christ, in the image of Jesus. And so this chain of reasoning then suggests then what you're seeing in Genesis 1 is a prediction, not a prediction, a foreshadowing, a type, a pattern of Jesus to come. And then as we are brought into Jesus through the gospel, we then become in his image, who is, in fact, in the image of God. So is Genesis 1 talking about, in fact, the one human who has ever properly been in the image of God, into whom other people are drawn and brought into the image of God through him. But again, a picture of Genesis 1 as one of these themes that then gets unpacked in the rest of the Bible, and of course particularly in the New Testament, about new creation. And there are others. There's things about the rest and Sabbath and so on as well. Okay, so what is Genesis 1? Well, like I said, I think it's unlikely that it's the first 7 days of the universe. I gave one point about that. More likely to be something like a tract against idolatry and a thematic synopsis or overture to the entire Bible. All right, now, we need to talk about Genesis 2. This one won't go on quite as long. So what is Genesis 1? We've got that. Now, that begs the question, what is Genesis 2? If I'm saying that the story starts in Genesis 2, well, there are interesting things that happen in Genesis 2. And remember, my job here is to try to persuade you that the Bible will allow an older scenario. Okay, so we need to deal with Genesis 2. So history in Genesis 2 and beyond. First of all, I want to say, in terms of the kind of history writing that we have in Genesis 2, I don't think there's any reason to expect it's anything like our modernistic sort of, footnoted history writing that we have today. I don't think that's the way anyone would have conceived of it at the time Moses was writing Genesis 2. But to try and help you see how that might be the case, or what kind of writing it might be, you can just look at Revelation 12. Revelation 12, 1-5. And I'll read this out to you, and then I'll ask you a question. A great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant, cried out in pain. She was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his heads. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth, so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. Now, here's your question. What is that describing? What historical events is that describing in particular?
The The birth of Jesus.
Wow, okay, all right. Yes, absolutely, right? I mean, for people who are familiar with the scriptures and familiar with Christian things, that's just obvious, right? That's what it's describing. But even the biblical accounts of the birth of Jesus don't have Mary with a crown of 12 stars on her head. There wasn't a dragon in the stable with the donkeys and whatever that was waiting to devour the child when it was born. So what do we make of this? Right? We know what it's talking about. It's talking about a historical event happened on this earth in our human history. Jesus was born in Bethlehem 2,000 years ago. But it sure isn't being described the way we're used to thinking about it, is it? If you had to think about it this way, if you had a video camera and you were standing there at the birth of Jesus, would it look like this? And I think we agree that no, it wouldn't look like that. But it's talking about real stuff that really happened in our own history. Why is it not possible that Genesis 2 and maybe some other chapter, maybe other chapters down the track? I mean, I think the Bible's a little bit less concerned about where that line is drawn than probably me and others are concerned. But we'll stick with Genesis 2 for the moment. I mean, could not Genesis 2 be that kind of writing? In fact, apocalyptic literature, one of the kind of origins of apocalyptic literature is creational literature. That's where apocalyptic literature often gets its themes from, is from creational literature. Well, maybe this is one of those cases. Maybe this creational literature of Genesis 2 is a situation where if you were standing there with a video camera, you wouldn't catch on film exactly what's described, the way it's described in the scriptures. Historical events. My minor correction was major to me because it's personal, but to what David said is I believe there was an Adam and an Eve. I believe a historical Adam and an Eve. I believe that this story happened. There was an original sin. Could it not be, though, that the type of writing that we have here is such that if you had a video camera, it wouldn't look like the way it was described? Possible. I think it's entirely, in fact, I think it's quite plausible that that's the case. In terms of where that kind of creational history or primordial history or something connects with something that we recognize a little bit more, where we can match up sort of cultural indications from, you know, Abraham or from or Moses or something with other information we have from the ancient Near East. Well, you know, where it feels a little bit more like it's a regular account, although I would say none of the Bible is in fact an actual, you know, dead-on, word-for-word sort of account of what happened. It's all theologically conditioned. The whole book is a theological tome. It's not a historical book in its first, in its origin. It's a theological book. Everything's been written with an agenda. But one way of thinking about how we kind of get from this history into history we, again, we might recognize, it's an illustration I've purloined from Stephen Hawking when he's talking about the beginning of the universe. In fact, a little bit of what Charlie was talking about before, like when you get back to that beginning, space-time looks a little bit messy, foam rather than a nice XY axis. Stephen Hawking describes it like, you know, a jumper, a woolen jumper, although he said sweater, but a woolen jumper that is kind of unraveled at the bottom. And he said you can kind of, back at the beginning of the universe, you can kind of find a thread and you can kind of trace it up and you just think, well, this is just a thread of wool. But then it starts getting woven in with a few other things, and then you get up to the top and you realize, oh, no, this is a jumper. That is, somewhere along the way, it became a jumper, but it's just hard to put your finger exactly on where it became the jumper. How do you define where the jumper started and where the single thread of wool left off? And I wonder if, again, the history in Genesis is similar. We're just not exactly sure. And again, that is not because I think these events that are described didn't happen. I'm saying, did they happen exactly in the way that...
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.